and Democratic Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey rose to the occasion with the longest speech in Senate history.
So tonight, I rise with the intention of getting in some good trouble. I rise with the intention of disrupting the normal business of the United States Senate for as long as I am physically able. I rise tonight because I believe sincerely that our country is in crisis.
He talked about the Trump administration's actions on many fronts, from budget cuts to health care to the assault on democracy. He says institutions that are special are being recklessly attacked and even shattered.
In just 71 days, the president of the United States has inflicted so much harm on Americans' safety, financial stability, the core foundations of our democracy, and even our aspirations as a people for, from our highest offices, a sense of common decency.
He began speaking on the Senate floor Monday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and he kept on speaking. Senator Dick Durbin is a Democrat from Illinois. He was one of a number of Democratic senators who gave Booker a break by asking a question, allowing Booker some relief without having to give up the floor.
Thank you. I first want to acknowledge this extraordinary moment in the history of the Senate. I believe you have been holding the floor now for more than 10 hours.
But Booker did not stop at 10 hours.
We have laid out what they're trying to do 20 hours. I want to stand more, and I will, but I'm begging people, don't let this be another normal day in America.
Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
Greetings, I'm Maimuna Youssef, and this is WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice.
Welcome to Africa Now. Today's show features the rhythms of Black freedom, Africa and Black internationalism. Africa Now is next. Welcome to the show. I'm Muiza Muntali. The music in the background is Africa by John Coltrane Quartet, and we play that commemorating Jazz Appreciation Month. As we begin Jazz Appreciation Month, the show goes into its archives and features a conversation from 2022 with Professor Tom Porter, who is the former member of CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality, and also former member of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and former head of the King Center in Atlanta, former director of Black Studies at Ohio University, former WPFW program director, and more. The discussion between Professor Tom Porter and Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope explores the rhythms of movement, the manifestations of the global Black freedom struggle, the impact of Black classical music in the struggle, programs of freedom, conceptualization of human rights, which is directly related to the temporal conditions produced from various forms of colonialism, slavery, apartheid, Jim Crow, institution building, Black radical thought, and Black internationalism. Here is James Pope with the conversation.
All right. Peace and greetings. Peace and greetings. Peace and greetings. Peace and greetings, everyone. Thank you for joining us tonight. Welcome to our program this evening, which is a collaboration with the Office of International Programs at Winston-Salem State University and Africa World Now Project. Tonight, we will engage in an organic discussion around the rhythms of freedom, Africa and Black internationalism. Tonight, we are in conversation with Tom Porter. Professor Porter is the embodiment of the concept of organizer intellectual, a former member of CORE, the Congress of Radical Equality, and SNCC, head of the King Center in Atlanta, former strategist and advisor to Jesse Jackson's presidential campaign, former chair of Black Studies, graduate director of Antioch Graduate Center in Washington, D.C., program director and longtime radio host, jazz critic, sociopolitical theorist, specifically specializing in Black radical thought, and author. Honestly, the list goes on and on. Professor Porter can be firmly placed in the tradition of the Black organic intellectuals, the ones we read about, the ones we study, the ones we hear about, and political philosophers. Tom, welcome for joining. Thank you for joining us tonight. How are you doing?
Thanks for having me.
No problem.
We're finally getting it done.
No problem. You know, it's an absolute pleasure for me to be having this conversation with you. You know, I've known you for a pretty long time, having, you know, multiple connections through some of, you know, a number of the folk that you have worked with over the years, a number of the people you have mentored over the years, you know, some of the experiences and things that you've shared over the years. It's a real pleasure to be talking to you tonight, Tom. And I've been trying to, and I mentioned this to you, I've been trying to find an opportunity for you to engage, you know, our students in the community. And also this is being streamed live on YouTube around the world, just to have this conversation so people can really understand, you know, some of the influences that they hear in my work, in my teaching, but also the influences, because you've influenced a lot of people. And with that being said, as we begin this conversation, let's begin this conversation by mapping your trajectory, mapping who you are, mapping how you developed your praxis, your theory, your praxis, understanding, you know, what we consider to be in our topic tonight, the rhythms of freedom. Tell us a little bit about Tom Porter.
Well, like many men and women of my generation, I've experienced a two-state experience. I was born in Montgomery, Alabama, and I grew up in Cincinnati, Ohio. And my grandfather was a farmer and had his own farm, and my father worked a farm. Met my mother, they got married and moved to Cincinnati when I was very, very young, but I spent a lot of my summers in Alabama. I was very, very fortunate. I was born into a family. Both of my parents were active union members. So there was always some activity going on in my house. Both of them were active union members and involved the struggle at many different levels. And having been born in Montgomery, Alabama, my family was very much involved in the Montgomery bus boycott. And so that's kind of been with me most of my life. Growing up in Cincinnati was a very interesting experience. Cincinnati was well known for its educational system, so that many Black men and women, beginning after the Civil War, sent their kids to Cincinnati to be educated. So I grew up in that kind of background, but I also grew up in a community which was a strong Black community. And so all of the people that I saw, even though segregation existed, all of the significant people that I saw for the most part were Black people, Black librarians, Black heads of the YMCA. And so I grew up in a very, very nurturing community and in Cincinnati, Ohio, called the West End, which was the largest Black community in Cincinnati. And up until a couple of years ago, every year they had what was known as the West End Dance. And we'd come back from wherever we were in the world to Cincinnati the first weekend in December. So I kind of grew up in that kind of background. I joined the Navy when I was 17 years old, which is a very, very good experience for me, because for the first time, I met young Black men and some women from all over the world. And it was amazing how bright and smart we were. And of course, the military was still segregated for the most part. And there were a lot of activities that we engaged in, This was the late 50s. And I was stationed in a little town called Milton, Florida. And the biggest place to go for recreation was Pensacola, Florida. And there were a number of activities that we had to engage in just to protect ourselves. And but also when I was in the Navy, there wasn't really that much to do. And so I gave myself various projects while I was in the Navy. I would decide that I'm going to read, for instance, about all the great religions in the world. Then I'm going to study the books written by about all of the great women in the world, Madame Bovary, Tess of D'Urberville, you know. And but I would do that, you know. And I've always had a rebellious side of me. And a Catholic chaplain on the base, he had a list of books called Suggested Officers Reading. And I was an enlisted man, and I would go and check books out of that section. There wasn't anything in it of note, but he would turn red as a beet. he was a Catholic chaplain. So all while I was in the military, 57 to 60, and I got out, decided that I would go to college. The first college I went to was OU and Ohio University, which is very interesting because on registration day, this was 1960, that when you came out of the library, there were all of these tables set up with different political groups. So the Communist Party had a table, the Socialist Party. So this was a time when stuff started heating up. And I got involved. I transferred to the University of Cincinnati because I needed to get a job. And so I worked nights at the post office, went to school full time during the day in the post office. The post office in the civil rights movement was my school, the greatest source of my education, because in the post office, it was called the graveyard of Black ambition. And the reason why it was called that, because Black men and women who had gone to college and university, mostly Black colleges and universities, in science and other fields, could not get jobs. And so among the petty bourgeoisie, they like to say that a Morehouse man and a Spelman woman is a marriage made in heaven. In a working class community, a post office worker and a school teacher is a marriage made in heaven. And so, but because they had all these brilliant Black men and women in the post office, there was an authority in the post office on everything. And these men and women were brilliant, and they were always, they would call it a day drop in science. I remember a guy telling me, an older guy in the post office, he told me, he said, young man, it's a skill game and a fool can't play it. And I still remember that to this day, you know. So and then I got involved in the Congress of Racial Equality. Cincinnati had a chapter. And at some point, I became chairman of Cincinnati Corps. And in 1964, Roy Ennis, there's a lot of history that's not talked about. When people talk about the civil rights movement, they tend to talk about the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and SCLC. Well, CORE was started in 1941, so it was older than all of those organizations. But in 1964, Roy Ennis and a bunch of right-wing Negroes, and this is in 1964, at the CORE convention in Kansas City, and I was there. And they expelled all of the radicals, including Julius Hobson from Cincinnati, who headed the statehood party, I mean from D.C. They expelled all of the radicals. As we came back from Kansas City in the car, there were four or five of us, and we started discussing what we're going to do because we didn't want to be a part of that. And at that time, SNCC was beginning to organized in the North. And so, like many Northern CORE chapters, we became affiliates of SNCC. And that was at the same time that the leadership had passed to Stokely Carmichael and the crew from Howard University, Charlie Cobb, Ralph Featherstone, it was DC. So there, at that same time, there was a switch in SNCC, and we were moving to the Black Power phase of the movement. And I spent, at the same time, I'm going to college. And at the same time, I was married when I was a sophomore in college. And my daughter was born, and one of my daughters was born the day that I finished undergraduate school. And so that's the other thing that people really don't, that people today, young people, they don't understand. But I didn't get paid for being chairman of CORE. I didn't get paid. I mean, you did that because you believed in it. So that was, and I remain active in SNCC, engaging in a lot of different activities. And of course, when Black Power, there were a lot of different things going on in the Black community. That's why I'm taking my time to say certain things, because we really need to have a comprehensive picture, I think, of what the movement was all about. There's a tendency to think that the movement only took place in the South. But there were movements, like I said, CORE started in 1941 in Chicago. So there were movements in Detroit, the rent strikes in Harlem. There were movements in Newark. I mean, there used to be Black arts conventions that took place in Detroit. That was in the 60s. I met Mary Baraka, who is Leroy Jones, in Detroit in 1967. So that, and these were big meetings and what have you. So Black Power was a rallying cry, but just like I tell people about Black Lives Matter, once you put it out there, you don't control it. So because the only reason why it catches on is that it was in the air to begin with, that people were ready for it. People were, we were tired of basically the nonviolent approach. It didn't mean that we were advocating violence, but it meant that the question of power and the need for power, the power to define who we were. There were big discussions about, are we Negroes, Black, African-Americans? There were serious discussions. I can remember sitting up at night at the university discussing the notion of the invisibility and Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man. So when a time comes, and there's a time in our struggle, even if they hadn't said Black Lives Matter, Black people have these, what I call, oh, hell no moment. I mean, George Floyd was one of the, oh, hell no, that's just too much. And so if you notice about at the time that Black Power became a rallying cry, there were serious rebellions across the country because, and they all started for the most part when the police were doing what they normally did, and they went too far in the minds of people. So there was this, oh, hell no moment. And so they've had these oh, hell no moments. And we can see it now that the community is saying, oh, hell no. And that's kind of the, I can't say that's the movement side of me because I never left the movement. every job that I had, for the most part, which the job was that came to me, for instance, I became Dean of African American Studies because the dean resigned, and there was a cadre of radical socialists, and they said, man, why don't you come out here? And I went out there first as a visiting professor to take the place of Lenny Wade Pettiford, who became for a minute the ambassador to the United States for the ANC for South Africa, but she was teaching at OU. And then I was known for somebody who could go to meetings and do budgets and what have you. We like the sexy side of the revolution, but the serious work.
Those budgets, putting everything together.
I had that, that reputation. I was radical enough. So that's how I became a Dean of African American Studies. But before that, I was a graduate student at Antioch. There are times in the movement where you have to make a move because the heat is on. And it was time for me to leave Cincinnati. The kind of confrontations that I was getting in, I could be a hero, but I'd have been a dead hero. So I enrolled in the Antioch Graduate School. At that time, they had a group of radical students there, and I got involved, and I'm still involved in SNCC. So I'm still organizing students at Central State, Wilberforce, and Antioch. So this was a graduate program, and they were training teachers to infiltrate the inner city. And so we were a bunch of Black students, and we could see the contradictions that they were setting up, because you could get a master's degree in 12 to 15 months. And they had all of these young white students who had been in the Peace Corps, who would get a master's and then be positioned to become assistant principals and principals in inner city schools. And we had one of those oh hell moments. So, no, that ain't right. And so I became the director of Antioch's graduate program as a result of student struggle. And it eventually became known as the Horace Mann Bond Center of Education. And we had, as members of the faculty, Bob Rhodes, Jack O'Dell, Tony Montero, Mary Terrell. We were crazy enough to think that we could use a socialist model of education to train teachers. Now, it worked because our students became principals, doctors, and lawyers and what have you. And you had to take methods of thought, political economy, and all of that. So it worked, but the federal government didn't like it. So same thing happened with the King Center. I went down to do one thing and ended up being the executive director of the King Center. And, I can talk in details about all those things. So that's kind of been my life. And, I'm 82 now. So I'm still involved. Yeah. And I certainly, it's an honor for me to be here and talk. But that's kind of a thumbshell. In the meanwhile, I was always involved with music.
Yeah. we're going to get to that. I just want to, you said so many different things in that particular moment. I wanted to whack up. And I really appreciate that, because what you just displayed is the multifaceted area, the multiple ways within which people were understanding how to struggle and the need to struggle. And I wanted to back up, particularly when you were talking about, SNCC, as when Stokely Carmichael takes over SNCC, there's a transition happening, not only in SNCC itself with those young folk, but also in the context of the communities around it. That's important as well. And you also talked about, you mentioned the Black Arts Movement, you mentioned your good friend, Amiri Baraka, and I want to back up to the point when you became the director of Black Studies at Ohio University.
Right.
Talk about the environment at that particular time. Talk about the study groups, the engagement with the community, and why people thought that they needed you to be the director of that particular program, and your understanding of the mix between Black power, Black arts, and also Black studies, because you were in that nexus right there.
Well, one of the essential ingredients of us in the civil rights movement. It's very, very interesting because the young people, when we were young, we represented, because there's a tendency for people to think that the radicals were not necessarily intellectuals or educated, just radical. Nothing could be further from the truth. Stokely Carmichael graduated from Bronx Science in New York, which at that time was the number one ranked public high school in the country. I'm an alumnus and graduate of Walnut Hills High School, which was number two in the country at that time. So we were not dummies by any means. And so one of the essential ingredients of the movement, even in the early days of SNCC, was reading and studying, whether it was Frantz Fanon, Regis Debray, Che Guevara. I mean, but we studied and discussed it, you know. And then there were people like, why am I blocking on his name? Jim Foreman, whose book, The Making of a Black Revolutionary, actually, in my mind, was the first person to bring revolutionary thought to the movement. So when I became dean of African American Studies, I had been involved. Antioch had one of the, if not first or second, Black Studies program in the country. And Ohio University maybe had the third. And so I had been involved in my SNCC work with students at these two schools. And Antioch was very famous. They had an all-Black dorm. And Kenneth Clark, who was on the board, obviously opposed it. But they also had, there were faculty members who traveled from campus to campus, kind of like circuit. And Bob Rhodes was one of those. Bob Rhodes is a person that most people have never heard of, and most people don't know anything about him. Bob Rhodes is the smartest person I ever met in my life. Bob Rhodes.
I vouch for that.
And he and Tony Montero, Harold Rogers, they would go between Ohio University and Antioch. And then when I became director of the graduate program, and we didn't make any bones about it. Our orientation was towards socialism. And we saw that you could use, I mean, the thing about socialism, or if you think about socialism, you think about Karl Marx. And the most important thing about the science of society is understanding that there are laws of social development, there are laws of thought, and you can learn these things and apply them to concrete situations. And so we studied this stuff, the history of philosophy, and what have you. So by the time I got involved with the graduate program, Ohio University had two students who were members of ANC who were on the faculty. And Lenny Way, as I said, went back. And Black Studies, there's always a struggle around Black Studies. Black Studies essentially was started by students, young people in the movement, not by the professional Black faculty members, came later. And so it was, we were young and excited about what we're doing. We actually thought that we would be able to overthrow this thing. But at the same time, there was so much going on in the arts, in the culture, in the politics, and what have you. So it was a very, very exciting very exciting time to be involved in, and to be involved with people who are talking about methods of thought, that there are different ways of looking at social reality, political economy, not political science, but political economy. But, you know, and these are young people. Some of the earliest faculty members in Black Studies were students themselves who stayed to really make sure that the program was what it should be. So it was very exciting. We turned out a lot of good students who are doing good things in the world, but Black Studies was always under attack. It's always under attack. I mean, Black Studies was something that the state agreed to, but didn't want to. So after they agreed to it, I walk around the campus and invariably some white faculty member would say to me, "Do you think we really need Black Studies?" You know, and so it was always under attack. And what eventually happened to Black Studies, we can see, and this is something that we may be able to get into a little bit later, that what happened to Black Studies? Why did Black Studies cease to be, for the most part, a place where students got a great education were radicalized? And it had to do with, there were a lot of people who came to the country and they became the choice of the establishments. And some of them were from the Caribbean, some of them were from Africa. And we see the same thing happening in the country now, who come here to engage in capitalism. And so there was, in many cases, no real commitment to Black Studies and no real commitment to the history of Black people. And so eventually these programs became marginalized and for the most part really don't exist in my mind as a real place of radical thought and what have you. Although there are a lot of PhDs, a lot of bright people out there, a lot of people writing and what have you, and I don't put that down. But I don't know of a Black Studies program that, because I haven't kept up, that I would call a serious Black Studies program. There's some people doing serious work.
You're listening to a portion of a discussion between Professor Tom Porter and African Now's co-host and executive producer, James Pope, which explores the rhythms of movement, the manifestations of the global Black freedom struggle, the impact of Black classical music in the struggle, programs of freedom, conceptualization of human rights, which were and is directly related to temporal conditions produced from various forms of colonialism, slavery, apartheid, Jim Crow, institution building, Black radical thought, and Black internationalism. And this is from our archives from 2022. The music in the background is The Revolution Will Not Be Televised by Gil Scott-Heron. And we play that remembering his birthday, which is April 1st. You're listening to Africa Now on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., your jazz and justice station. Now back to the conversation.
And I wanted to chime in here because, yes, we do want to get to that question of what happened to Black Studies. But, you know, when you talk about seriousness, and one of the things that I look at, particularly when you're talking about Black Studies, is the fact that the connection with the community, because, again, it's very, very important to understand when you're talking about Black Studies as a intellectual formation that was already formed in the communities and being brought onto the campus. So when you say, and I want to make sure that, you know, folk who are attending here tonight, so when you're saying, you know, this having this question of what happened to Black Studies, but also substantive Black Studies, are you targeting the fact that many of these particular programs have professionalized themselves away from community and struggle in the community as well?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, the issue of becoming tenured and published to Perry. I mean, people got caught up in that. I don't have a PhD. I've had every opportunity to work on one. I was admitted to University of Cincinnati, the first Black to admit it to the PhD program. So it's not that I haven't had an opportunity. I was just too busy to really deal with that. I don't really put that down, but I was a tenured faculty member at Ohio University, and I left because it was just unconnected to the community. I mean, I left. I was a tenured faculty member. I could have stayed out there. And once the professional faculty people came in, the issues changed. There was no longer the issue of really educating students, of really connecting Black, keeping Black studies connected to the community where it come from. And to become professionals and form professional associations and write endless books and papers and what have you. And some of them are great. Most of them are hardly get read by people outside of the academy. But that happened in every phase of our lives, the political lives, the Black caucus and the people who organized the Gary Convention are altogether different than these people in the Black caucus today. Mm-hmm. And so all of that happened as a result of the intrigue of the state in league with professional Blacks who wanted to become professional Blacks.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Gary, and I actually wrote a note to talk about Gary, Gary, Indiana. Talk about, link what you're saying in the context of this contestation between the professionalization of education and Black folk being in education and what was happening at the time, with Gary in Gary, Indiana. Like what was that like? I mean, again, everybody's coming together to develop a platform, a Black agenda, so to speak. Can you talk a little bit about, maybe some of your work around that and other people that you were involved with in that particular endeavor?
Well, at the time of the Gary Convention, I was executive director of the Kings in Atlanta. And so I attended the convention with Mrs. King and other members of the staff. 1972, Dick Hatcher was the mayor of Gary, Indiana, but he was also, I think, vice chairman of the Democratic Party. And you had a strong Black caucus. A Black caucus that was concerned not only about the national struggle, but the international struggle. Charlie Diggs, who was one of the conveners out of Detroit, was a real authority on struggle in Africa and pushing that agenda into Congress. Amiri Baraka, who was, there were three conveners, Amiri Baraka, Charlie Diggs, and Dick Hatcher, who were president. And again, it was an idea that starts in the streets, people talking about what we need. And so this notion of a Black convention was something that was out there. But it was a time when pieces fell in place. Dick Hatcher was vice president of the Democratic Party, but also he was mayor of Gary, Indiana. And as mayor, Jesse Jackson could have run for president, but he could not have run for president in the way that he ran and in the way that he announced, if it were not for the fact that Mayor Marion Barry was the mayor of D.C., so he could give him the convention center. There were certain resources. And so although Gary, Indiana was a small city by city standards, Dick Hatcher had certain resources, and you need to be able to have buildings and schools where you can have meetings and what have you, when you control the police force and what have you. And so the elements came together at that time. And I mean, Amiri Baraka, who had always been a force in the cultural nationalist community, then in the nationalist community, revolutionary nationalist community. And at the time that he left, he was openly saying that he was a communist. So, but he had always been organizing. He had always been respected as an organizer. He commanded great respect, so that all of those things came together at the same time that with the assassinations of Martin and Malcolm and other lesser assassinations of Black people across the country, there was also this sense that we needed to move our struggle on another level. And so that was Gary. And if you have not read the agenda that came out of Gary, it is a blueprint. There has not been an agenda in the Black community that measures up to the agenda that came out of Gary. That's not to say that it does not to be refined, but it's certainly a good framework to discuss the issues that involve the entire African world.
And to talk about that, you're also talking about the fact that if we want to put some language on this, is that when you talked about developing at Antioch a multidisciplinary way of addressing Black folk, this is also in a tradition or a genealogy or a legacy of Black folk who were resisting using radical ideas and thoughts to really mold an agenda which brings everybody to Gary, Indiana at that particular point in time. And speaking of that, and I wanted to kind of pull on this, you mentioned Bob Rhodes, and you know, of course, I came to know Bob Rhodes through you, but also the fact that you convened at Antioch a all-star knowledge production cast of people, because not only did you have Bob Rhodes there, you also had Jack O'Dell. Jack O'Dell, could you talk a little? And let me also make this point. I want this to be on record. We talk about intelligent people, but you have to be clear about people who bring intelligent people together. So there has to be a level of intelligence to bring people together on par to understanding how knowledge is produced, particularly Jack O'Dell, Robert Rhodes, and you talked about Tony Montero. Could you talk a little bit about this? Is and doing Antioch was obviously, this was after the convention, correct? This is
right.
Talk a little bit.
It was let's see, 72. Yeah, it was after.
Yeah. So talk about how you are looking at this, you and the crew and the folk you're running with. You're looking at this and carrying this agenda even after that, even, you know, developing an understanding that we need to train folk to get into the community. We need to train folk to get into the universities. And you're doing that at the same time. It's not just stay in a university. You guys are training folk to do both at the same time, to constantly, you know, push this agenda, or push it to its inevitable conclusion. If there was a conclusion, if there is a conclusion.
You know, when our students who came through the Antioch Graduate School of Education, which also had an undergraduate component, and one time I was head of the undergraduate component as well as the graduate component, students refer not to, they don't refer to it as Antioch Graduate School of Education, they say the center. And our students, people who came through that, even today I talked to Grossbeck Parham, who was a student at Antioch, was my assistant for a while. He is now working in Zambia on cervical cancer in African women and is known the world over, including at the World Health Organization, where he co-chairs a commission on cervical cancer. And these are the kind of students that came out. Mary Terrell became a judge, but all of them stayed rooted. And that was because of the presence of involved intellectuals like Jack O'Dell or Bob Rhodes. I mean, if you can, well, most people never knew Bob Rhodes, but I had the pleasure of having lunch on a regular basis with Bob Rhodes and Jack O'Dell. Jack O'Dell was called by J. Edgar Hoover the most dangerous man in America because of his influence on Dr. Martin Luther King. Jack was a leading strategist, not just in the Black movement, but in the world movement, and, you know, saying freeze. Jack was responsible for my meeting Yasser Arafat. Jack was responsible for me going to a lot of places around the world that I've never, through his connections and contacts. But he was, do yourself a favor. Jack has, he was an authority on what he called a special variety of colonialism, the Black condition in America. So you should read his stuff in Freedom Ways, where he was an associate editor. And I remember early on at Antioch, some of the white students were concerned that Jack didn't have a degree. And they actually rebelled and came to me. And I said, if Jack does get a degree, I'm going to fire him. I mean, here you have a man who had been a merchant seaman. I mean, Jack was one of the most brilliant strategists, political strategists. And he's not only was the influential around Dr. King, but he was also the person more than anybody who took Jesse from being a country preacher to being a person who began to think about larger issues. You know, just every day having lunch with Bob Rhodes and Jack O'Dell, and the two of them were constantly challenging each other. So it was like being on a basketball court with LeBron James and Michael Jordan, you know. And I would just listen, and I used to say to myself, I'm sure that they're saying, and it's the, in this discussion, he's not in it. And I would laugh and say, but guess what? I'm the one that's signing the paychecks. But we had a good crew, and we were very, very influential in the politics of D.C. and the politics of the overall movement. For one of the peace movements, we were peace marches. We were the center here in D.C. And we had people coming through lecturing, like John Henry Clark, Horace Mann Bond. I mean, the people who came through lecturing were who's who of that generation of Black intellectuals. And so to expose students to dialectical and historical materialism, to teach a course like Methods of Thought, where you deal with the history of thought. And you know, you have students who never thought they would read Hegel or Marx or Fanon, you know. And so taking these students, what we found is that if given a scientific approach to looking at the world, it is amazing what you can do with that. Whether you go to law school or medical school, it is amazing just by looking, having another way of looking at the world and understanding that just like there are laws of physics and laws of biology, there are laws of thought. And there are laws of social development, how societies develop over time. And when you're exposed, see the danger, the fear of communism or Marxism is not a fear of the ideology. It's the fear. Marx analyzed capitalism better than anybody in the entire world to this day. But he did it with his method of approach. His method of approach. And so his method of thought, I mean, Marx was not an authority on communism. It didn't really exist other than theoretically. You'd have to get to Lenin before you got to that, a real authority on that. But he was an authority on capitalism, of capitalist development, on methods of thought. And so when you expose, and you know, you say, why are you talking about that? Well, it is amazing because most of the people who I respected were people like Paul Robeson or Du Bois, Oliver Cox, these great black intellectuals were people who had no problem with that. And so it was an exciting, in fact, we're gonna have a reunion of the center this coming spring, if we can pull it off, of all of our students.
Oh my goodness. I definitely would love to be in that. I wanted to tease something out. I cannot let this slide, because something that you just said, and I want to make sure that we tease this out. You just said a very, very important thought in the context of Marx and communism and socialism. You said tease that out, expound upon the notion that you just said. It's not the ideology they're scared of, it's the actual working process that it is scared. If you're moving in this direction, the scientific process, then you're going to follow, then that will also follow a conclusion. So if you are disrupting who controls the means of production, then what you're doing is actually going to lay out a certain level of thought that will follow, and actions will follow after that. Talk a little bit about that. I can't let that slide, because it was a very important point that I wanted to kind of tease out of what you just said.
Well, Cuba is a good example how you could take a poor country of people who were, in many cases, semi-illiterate. For the most part, it was a backward country. And I remember meeting a woman from Cuba who said, before the revolution, I couldn't read and write, and now I have a PhD. And so Cuba has not advanced as a society because they were holding guns on everybody. I remember Fidel speaking, said, you may find some students in Cuba who don't have all of the clothes that they need, but you would not find a young person in Cuba who doesn't have pen and paper. And so by using the scientific method of what we call the science of society, that Cuba was able to turn around an entire society and for its size to be a world leader. And if it were not for the blockade and the sanctions on Cuba, it would rival the United States in many ways, even though it's a very, very small country.
Just been listening to a portion of a conversation from our archives, which took place between Professor Tom Porter and African Owl's executive producer and co-host James Pope, which explored the rhythms of movement, the manifestations of the global Black freedom struggle, the impact of Black classical music in the struggle, programs of freedom, conceptualization of human rights, which were and is directly related to the temporal conditions produced from various forms of colonialism, slavery, apartheid, Jim Crow, institution building, Black radical thought, and Black internationalism. The conversation took place in 2022, and this was a conversation in collaboration between Africa World Now Project and Winston-Salem State University's Office of International Programs, a contribution of people of African descent to global society, justice, and freedom. The full conversation will be available on Africa Now's SoundCloud page, and that's at Africa Now Online on SoundCloud, and is available on Africa World Now Project Collective's YouTube page. The music in the background is Patience by Huma Sakela. And we play that remembering Huma Sakela's birthday, which is April 4th. And we also play that commemorating Jazz Appreciation Month. That's it for Africa Now for today. I'm your host, Moise Mutale. Up next is Headline News, followed by Shanana with Zain Al-Amin, which looks at issues in Northern Africa and the Middle East. And that's followed by the women's collective Sophie's Parlor, which is followed by The Browder File with Tony Browder, which is followed by Black Agenda Radio with Margaret Kimberly, and that's followed by Kombi Lakai with Eugenia Charles looking at issues in Haiti. Check out Africa Now on Facebook and on X, formerly Twitter. That's at Africa Now Online. Also, Africa Now is archived on iTunes Podcast and on SoundCloud. Search under Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. Thanks to Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope. And thanks to our engineers Michael Nicella and Claire Chapman. And thanks to our research fellow volunteers Chanda Kozer and Fernand Gonda. And our Africa World Now Project collective of Dr. Tasmin Siddiqui, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, Dr. Josh Myers, and Kurt Utterson. And thanks to the entire team here at WPFW and to you for joining us. Continue to support all the great programs on WPFW. Our closing song is God Bless the Child by Billie Holiday. And we play that remembering Billie Holiday's birthday, which is April 7th. And also,
for WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Wednesday, April 2nd. Here are some headlines. Israel announced a major expansion of its military operation in Gaza today, one that will involve seizing large areas of land from the Palestinians in an effort to, quote, crush and clear the area of terrorists and terror infrastructure, close quote. Israeli Defense Minister Israel Katz said the operation will involve a large-scale evacuation of Gaza's population, after which time these areas will be incorporated into Israel's security zones. The announcement followed a night of intensive airstrikes on Khan Yunis and Rafah in southern Gaza, which hospital officials said killed at least 21 people. The latest UN estimate from March 23rd suggested more than 140,000 people had been displaced since the end of the ceasefire, more than 90% of the Strip's population of 2.3 million have been forced to flee their homes during the conflict, many of them multiple times. In domestic news, a liberal won Wisconsin's Supreme Court election yesterday, while two Florida Republicans won their special elections to fill U.S. House vacancies. In Wisconsin, liberal Susan Crawford defeated conservative Brad Schimmel, despite billionaire Elon Musk pouring over $20 million into a campaign to oppose her. Her victory maintains a 4-3 liberal majority on the court in the battleground state and offers a warning sign for Republicans that Musk could damage their advantage in other key elections. In Florida, voters selected Republicans Jimmy Patronis and Randy Fine to replace former Representatives Matt Gaetz and Mike Waltz. However, in another warning sign for the GOP, the margins of victory for Patronis and Fine in the deeply red districts were about half of the margins for Waltz and Gaetz just 5 months earlier. In more news, the Trump administration initiated another wave of drastic workplace reductions yesterday, this time focusing on employees at U.S. health agencies. Broad cuts were enacted at CDC divisions working on issues ranging from chronic illness, workplace health and safety, and HIV, to reproductive health and violence prevention. At the FDA, the entire staff of the press office were put on leave, as well as employees working in the Office of Policy and International Engagement and the Office of Regulatory Programs. everyone at the Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program, which provides millions of poor and working-class Americans with assistance for their heating and cooling bills, was terminated. Layoffs also hit the entire staff at the